Thursday in New York City. It's PRN.FM. My name's Mark Farrell. Well, the rain has subsided. And you know what? It's good to get a good dousing in New York every once in a while because the city needs it, you know? If we could only get all this water down into the subway to really give it a good purging. Well, speaking of purging, the Mets. Well, you know what? The Mets, this is kind of like part and parcel for the Mets. I mean, they don't do anything easily, right? Everything comes along a little bit more difficult for them. So they're down two games. They lost last night 7-1. And apparently they got on a plane, touchdown, got to their stadium this morning at 4 a.m. They just want to put as much distance between them and Missouri as possible. And they have. So game three is tomorrow night. And 3, 4, and 5. So we're looking forward to that. Because, I mean, here's the reality. Again, I have to stipulate this by saying I'm not a baseball fan, but I am totally into watching this series. I don't know a lot about it. But the reality is, I mean, if you follow baseball, you know, Mets, this is their World Series. I mean, if they don't win it, this is great. I mean, they've gotten this far. It's pretty incredible. Of course, Met fans and New York fans pretty much in general want them to pull it through. But Kansas City is kind of a force to be reckoned with. So the reality is, if they don't do it, it's still a great... I'll stop right there. I don't want to jinx anybody. I'm going to move right on. Go Mets. Let's rock it out. Let's get the pitching back on and some hitting. Daniel Murphy, come on, man. Let's rock it out. Got a great show in store for you. A book that's come out a few months ago that's really doing well. It's called Modern Family: Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. It's by Joshua Gramson. And it maps the large, complex terrain of modern kinship and presents a personal and intimate account of social change from the inside out. I mean, this is crazy stuff. It's wild. It's a sociologist's point of view from a gay father of two daughters. It tells a variety of unconventional family creation tales. Very, very compelling stuff. You are going to meet one woman. It's going to sound like multiple people, but one woman, Elaine Kwan, who's a concert pianist, MIT professor, five-time national taekwondo champion, and a Wilhelmina model. Can you believe that? I mean, her bio reads like multiple people. Maybe she is cloned, because how could one person be all this? She's very, very compelling. And also, she's the co-founder and president of the innovative concert series Savor Your Senses, which is happening November 6th right here in New York City, where you can hear some great live music paired with wine. Sign me up. Yeah. So it's a big weekend around here, besides, of course, the Mets playing on Friday. New York City Marathon is on Sunday, Marathon Sunday, and it's probably one of the most exciting days in New York City within a year. I mean, everyone just comes together for this incredible event. It goes through five boroughs, as you know. It's over 50,000 people at this point. The last time I ran it was 97, I believe. And it was incredible. It was about 35,000-ish back then. It just brings back some great memories. I'm going to run it next year, and I want to see it this Sunday. I'm actually not going to be able to see my dear friend Debbie Blanding running for her first time, and I know she's going to do great. She's been training her you-know-what off, and we wish her all the best. And I was telling her about how exciting it is. I mean, it starts off – actually, the start of the race is actually the hardest part. Maybe not so much this year because it's not going to be that cold, but when you go and participate running a New York City Marathon, you have to be there hours, sometimes 4 hours before the start of the race. That's unheard of. That's a half a night's sleep right there. And the last time I did it, it was so cold. People were actually breaking into local buildings. It's actually a, I think it's a park that's right there, because people, it was about high 30s or so, and people were just freezing. They were looking for any warmth possible. So that's the hardest part, I think, of the marathon day, is just killing all that time, especially in the cold. And it's pretty neat. You're going through all these gates. You hear all these different languages broadcasting over the PA system, giving instructions. It's like you're in a different world, different country, and that's really kind of exciting. You're meeting people from all over the continent, the globe, that come over here. And I'd say I think about 15,000 or so are international runners. So the gun goes off, you go over the Tappan Zee Bridge, and it's pretty wild because you actually feel the bridge vibrating, because you figure 30, 40, 50,000 people jumping up and down at different times, this bridge is going to move. And that's not even the funniest part. The funniest part is seeing thousands of people peeing off the Tappan Zee Bridge. I'm sorry, I said the Tappan Zee. Verrazzano. I misspoke. Sorry about that. Verrazzano. Yes, because, you know, it's kind of a slow go when you're going over the bridge. And if you got to go, it's a great time to go. And why not piss like, three football fields high off the ground into the water? And then there's a New York City Fire Department barge right there just blasting water up in the air. And I don't know what's has got a larger pail of water, the runners or the fire company. But it's very, very cool. You go through Brooklyn. And that is probably one of the most exciting things because the crowds in Brooklyn are just incredible. I mean, every inch of every sidewalk is just people cheering. And that's the thing that pulls you through all five boroughs, all 26.2 miles. It's pretty amazing. Also, the music. The music, the innovative music. I'm talking really good bands to this must be their first day playing an instrument. But it's great because it's motivating and they're totally into it. And it's, I mean, from the Bronx where you have these huge speakers like bigger than me and you hear the subwoofers from a few blocks away. It's so motivating, empowering. And again, everybody wants to shake your hand, give you a high five. And actually, I remember the first time I ran it, you get to the halfway point and I was kind of crestfallen because they're like, and the winner for 1997's New York City Marathon is, I'm like, are you kidding? The winner crossed the line and I'm at the halfway point. I got another 13 miles. Oh no, this is crazy. But you got to get that out of your mind. Obviously, I'm not a pro. 59th Street Bridge is another highlight. You're running up to on the bridge and you think you're going to end up in the pearly gates because it just doesn't seem like it's going to end. And all of a sudden it starts to descend and you go down and you hear nothing but footsteps. And all of a sudden you hear this cacophony of sound. And it's like, what is that? It gets a little bit louder, louder and louder. You turn a corner, come down a ramp, and all of a sudden you see First Avenue and all these bright colors. And it's just a sea of spectators. Thousands and thousands of people just screaming your name if you have your shirt on. That's actually one thing I said to my friend Debbie. I said, listen, wear a shirt with your name on it because the crowd pulls you along. Hey, Debbie. Hey, beautiful. Come on. Run faster. You're doing great. Whatever it takes, you know. It's really, really cool. And as a matter of fact, a few times the first two times I gave somebody a high five that had like official looking New York City Marathon outfits on. I was like, what is that? And I didn't realize because being visually impaired, they had signs on them or T-shirts that said, you know, Vaseline. So when you give them a high five, they're wearing plastic gloves. And I got Vaseline on my hands because runners want that to prevent chafing. And I won't go into more detail about that. Use your imagination. But I'm like, how am I going to get this crap off my hands? This is crazy. But it's really cool. And I really, really enjoy it. I mean, it's the one day where New York City's really, really unite. And I feel like the marathon for me and for a lot of people is everything up till the day of the marathon. The training, the 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, the endless miles, the August training long run days of 15, 18, 20 miles, September. You know, you have to wake up 6 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning sometimes to get the mileage in. The burden it puts on your schedule, family, friends, work, it takes a lot. And so the day of the marathon, my philosophy is you go out and you have a good time because you're susceptible to so many things happening. I mean, someone falling into you, getting a sprained ankle, hitting the wall. The wall's physically when you feel like you can no longer move anymore because your body produces lactic acid and it's really painful. And, you know, it takes a lot of culprits, a lot of people down, victimized because of that. But, you know, proper training and things like that can mostly keep that at bay. But it's just an amazing event. So I'd say it's probably one of the coolest things I've ever done. And obviously you can tell by how excited I am just about talking about it. And one of the neatest things was a few years ago, I got to interview one of the greatest female runners, marathon runners, Greta Weitz. Now, Greta Weitz is known for many, many things, winning a lot of Olympic gold medals for many years. And also, unfortunately, she's also known for when she was running a marathon. Let me do a little aside here. When you do run the marathon, certain things do happen anatomically. Not to all people and not to all the time. Like for one example is like I was running 15 miles and sometimes your bowels just say, okay, here I come. Yeah, and that happens. And you have to go. I mean, you have like seconds to prepare and find a place. So that unfortunately happened to Greta Weitz, and She was not able to find a place. She was one of the lead runners, and it went south on her leg. So imagine that. So it was great thrill to interview one of the greatest female runners of all time a few years ago. A great, dear, sweet person who loves running, devoted to the sport, and to obviously, and this is important, to help up-and-coming runners, to establish them in the forefront, whether they're in high school level, collegiate, national circuit, international, whatever the case may be. And I think that's so important in terms of giving back to all the best of luck to all the runners. And no, more importantly, if you're in the New York City area, come out and cheer people on. It's because not only will it inspire them, it will inspire you. It's just, it's like going to see Rocky five times in a row because there's so much positive energy. It's so palpable. It's just amazing to be a part of it. So I urge you to come in. You're going to have a brunch, a couple of drinks, go out, cheer people on. It's a great thing. So what's your idea of the American nuclear family? You know, it's been just turned upside down. The image has been portrayed for so many years in a certain way. You know, you got the mother, the father, 2.5 kids, the dog. The dog is probably what I throw into complete like the Norman Rockwell picture of it, right? Well, you know, that's far from gone, far from true nowadays. Certainly it's been turned upside down. And there's a new book out to prove that, and it's doing so. Modern Family is the name of the book. Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship maps the large, complex terrain of the modern kinship and presents a personal, intimate account of social change from the inside out. And joining me now is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. I'm pleased to welcome Joshua Gamson. Hey, Joshua, how are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. How's the weather out there, my friend?
It's beautiful, and you just made me want to go out for a run.
Yeah, no kidding. Are you a runner?
I hadn't messed up my knee. I was.
Have you done New York?
No, my husband has.
Well, you got a bad knee because you live in San Francisco.
Yeah, you know. Well, I live in Oakland. It's a little flatter here.
A little flatter. Yeah.
So, I used to run in around the park in New York, around Central Park. So
your book is amazing on many levels, and trying to wrap my head around where to actually begin. I usually don't have to think about where to begin interviews. It just naturally comes to me. But at this point in time, I had to think about where do I start with this, because there are so many points of entry. And then I realized that, you know what, and this may sound Pollyanna-ish of me and corny, but it all starts, I think, with love.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and, you know, one place to to be honest, that's partly where the book started itself. You know, that's one place to start, is where did the, you know, what's the seed of the book? And it started in part from love, because, you know, we had just had our first kid, and I was surprisingly hormonal. I didn't realize
that was
going to happen. Like, when you hold a baby, I thought it was just something that happened if you carried a child.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was a lot of love and emotion and sleeplessness in, you know, the early months.
How long ago was that, Joshua?
She's now nine.
Nine. And you
nine
have
and a half.
Two children, two daughters, correct?
Ago, yeah. Yeah, a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. And, you know, I knew that we had this extraordinary story of how we made our family, well, in that case, our first child. And I wanted to get it on paper, and that was coming from a place of love. I wanted to make sure that my kids knew their origin stories, especially since they were so remarkable and elaborate and complex. And, you know, I grew up with a story that was kind of, most like most people I know, it was like, you know, one paragraph. Like, you know, they were having a party and I was late, and then I decided to come out and, you know, they toasted me. And that's the end of the story. My kids have much longer.
Yeah,
more
I'd say so. They have a couple hundred
but
pages.
But what I was going to say is that the other piece of it was other people's responses when Reba, our first child, was an infant and we'd be walking around. There was a lot of questioning that I didn't think other people, or basically straight couples, were getting with babies. Like, where did you get her was probably the most common one. After a compliment, you know, oh, she's so cute.
Did you say Walmart?
She was. I had that experience where you come up with your good lines
exactly.
Afterwards.
Yeah, of course.
But it happened enough that I did start to develop lines like, you know, well, where'd you get yours? Or, you know, I had a kind of snarky thing going on in my head, because I felt like this is so impertinent, and it has to do with the fact that we're two men,
and
people,
it's none of your business.
Don't get it, and it's none of your business. But then, you know, we had this one experience where someone asked that a few months in, and Richard, my husband, said, you know, got mad. And she, the woman who asked, started to cry, and it came to be revealed that she wasn't asking in that way that was, you know, it's none of my business. She was a person who had wanted to have kids, didn't have kids, had remarried. She still wanted to have kids. Her new husband had already gone through that, you know, didn't want to go through it again, et cetera. So she was mourning the loss of that dream and saw us and was sort of identifying with us. And after that, I started to rethink the questioning. For, you know, I didn't see it so much as these rude intrusions as people are really...
True.
Some, there are some of that, but that people are really curious about not so much these different family structures, which I think they people are aware of, the diversity of types of families, depending on where they live, whether those are single-parent families or you know, blended families or adoptive families or same-sex couple families and so on.
Or multi-parent.
But about how they how you got there, what it was like to build a family like that, how you did where did this kid come, you know, really, where did the kid come from?
And I think that can be applied, excuse me, Joshua, to many different things. It's sometimes the insensitivity, but more it's for their own edification. It's just the actual questioning is not as soft or as, you know, polite as you would like it to be.
Yeah, people don't know how to ask.
They don't.
And then when I figured out that's what they were asking, I was like, well, all right, I can tell them. I can write a book in which I tell these stories.
Well, let's back up a little bit. First and foremost, congratulations on being able to legally be married.
Thank you.
That's very cool. How
you
long
too.
Ago was this? Yeah, how'd you know I was married?
Well, I'm just saying, you have the right.
Oh, yeah, true.
We got married in Massachusetts in 2004, which is pretty much when it was first
enacted,
legalized in Massachusetts.
Sure.
And then we were, you know, married in Massachusetts and not married everywhere else we went. So it was kind of funny. Then we were married in California for a little while. Then they withdrew that and then they gave it back. And then finally, yeah, now we're married everywhere.
In all 50 states.
Paying taxes, yeah.
Was your long-term plan to have kids?
Yeah, we started talking about it very early on, you know, arguing it through,
visualizing
it. On the same
page?
What's that?
On the same page, both of you, in terms of how to
go
about it?
No, not really, not at the beginning. I mean, we were on the same page about wanting to have kids, which, you know, that's a big thing in any relationship.
Absolutely.
I think if there's disagreement on that, that can really be a deal breaker. But we weren't on the same page about how we wanted to do it. Richard was much more interested in us, one of us or both of us having some biological connection to the child. I was much more open to adoption, but also felt like, well, it's not my obligation as a gay guy to adopt. I mean, you know, we can reproduce biologically too. So, you know, we had to get on the same page about what we were imagining, how we would imagine doing it, and we landed on surrogacy arrangement that was more intimate. The first one, anyway, was more about people we knew helping
was
us out.
As did you predict sort of how it was going to be expedited in your mind, or was it easier and more complicated
to do the surrogacy
exactly.
and in vitro fertilization and all? I mean, I knew it was complicated, but I didn't know the specifics of the complications. You know, there were, in both cases we used, it's, our kids are from two different, carried by two different surrogates with two different egg donors, and then we're each a sperm donor, basically, for one or the other kid. And, you know, in each case, there were legal obstacles that, you know, I didn't know about. There was a lot of learning there that I had to do. I sort of managed the medical arrangements for the first child, you know, to let, we were in different geographical locations there, you know, when you've got four people involved, well, three people for the reproduction, the biological reproduction process we had, and, you know, their partners and husbands and wives and so on. That was a lot of people involved. So,
it sounds
I didn't
complicated,
anticipate
yeah.
that. And then, you know, we, at the end, when we were waiting for Reba to be born, we went to hang out at my parents' house. We all agreed she'd be born in Massachusetts, and that's where they live. And, you know, it was emotionally complicated because there we were in a house awaiting this baby. And then once she was born, you know, feeding her and changing her and so on, Richard, Tamar, who carried and gave birth to Reba, her then husband, Andy, and me in a house, you know.
Wow. That's powerful
like
stuff.
Like a 3-week group marriage.
Yeah.
You know, loving and getting on each other's nerves and, you know, all of it. So, and then there was the saying goodbye to them when we went back to California. And
did you feel, did you feel like you're taking, I mean, you're literally taking a part of them, but did you feel any slight sense of remorse?
No, I wouldn't call it remorse. It was sadness. You know, we were all really in it together. It was a very beautiful experience, even if it was emotionally complex, mm-hmm. in terms of knowing that they had to detach, in particular Tamar had to detach. But we had thought about that. This is a very deliberate, long process, which is one of the advantages, I think, that go along with having to sort of do it yourself.
Did you stay in touch with them after?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tamar, I forgot to mention, was my college girlfriend.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know,
I'd say it's a big thing to forget
for
to mention,
time.
Joshua.
What's that?
Yeah, it's a big thing to oversight. Did she have any, I would imagine some women would experience depression.
No. I mean, she was, you know, you'd have to talk to her about that,
sure.
But not in my understanding
of it or
recollection of it. She was, you know, depression is different from sadness. She felt the loss.
Yes.
But she also, you know, that was offset by the fact that she knew that she's part of our family, and that's, you know, that's a lifelong attachment that she's going to maintain. It's going to be, she's not going to be in that sort of close attachment that she had when she had the baby growing inside of her.
Wow.
So she felt sad about, you know, the way you do when you separate
absolutely.
From people when you're, you know, I don't know, going off to college, or it was more like that. But I think she was also relieved. She didn't, you know, she went to sleep. You know, we were just starting. She knew her job was done and she could go back to her life.
Part.
And that's what she planned.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
What she wanted, you know. So, and we see them regularly, even though they're no longer together as a couple. We see them. The girls, both of our kids, go to Tamar's annual family reunion, so they've kind of got this extended kin on through Tamar, who
fantastic.
They call Aunt Tamar, and you know, you kind of just mix it up.
Sure. And how was this topic broached about her being the surrogate mother?
With whom?
With
her?
Your former girlfriend. Yeah.
I had a dream that she was giving birth, and I called her up because I hadn't talked to her in a while. I know, I don't want to be
great.
All mystical about it, but
that's
there
great.
Was, you know,
it.
That is the genesis of the child, is I called her up and I said, are you, you know, I had this dream, just curious. And I wasn't thinking, will you carry our child? I was thinking, I should call Tamar and see what's going on. Like maybe she's pregnant and I'm clairvoyant. And she said, nah, you know, we've decided long ago that we don't want to have kids. We have lots of kids in our lives. That's not the life we want. And I said, oh, that's interesting. And, you know, she said, I just regret not having had the experience of pregnancy and childbirth, you know, just something I wanted being born into this body, even though I don't want to raise kids. And that's when the light bulb went off. And I said, you know, I think I have a deal for you.
So what are you doing this weekend?
Exactly. And she said, I'll mull it over, which shocked me because I was joking. I was like, nobody's going to do this for us.
That's great. That's phenomenal.
That's how
I mean,
it started.
It's totally meant to be,
you know,
when you hear something like
that.
That's why I wanted
to tell that story.
Sure.
It's so beautiful.
Joshua, tell me about, I mean, the book has lots of different stories. Tell me the story about Aldo, a boy with two mothers.
Yeah. So these are, now, that's a range of stories. It's all, just for context, it's all people I know and am connected to. I decided to do it that way. It's not like, you know, a sociological study where I sampled different mm-hmm. types of family creation or something. This was just the people around me. And it includes straight parents, multi-parent families. So one of
which
them,
I definitely want to touch on after this, multi-parent
families.
Yeah,
they're interesting. any non-conventional family creation process that I knew in my immediate network, I approached people. And so Aldo is the child of former neighbors of ours in our previous house. we used to see all the time. And when one of the couple, it's a lesbian couple, when she was pregnant, I thought, oh, she did it the way all my lesbian friends do. You know, they went to the sperm bank, they selected sperm, and they inseminated, and, you know,
aisle
it's relatively
six.
Easy and don't need no man. You know, they just did it. And then I came to find out as I got to know them better that what they had decided to do was use in vitro fertilization. And this has become something that I've heard more about since then, but at the time it was very unusual. Take the eggs of one woman in the couple and fertilize those eggs through donated sperm, which they did select from a sperm bank. And then when the embryos were fertilized, I mean, this is how in vitro works, then they implanted into the uterus of the other woman.
So preheat oven had, for 350 and bake for 9 months?
Yeah, basically.
Pretty much.
I'm not sure the exact temperature, but yes.
Okay.
You know, so they, what they really, really wanted was for both of them to have some biological connection, biological
Absolutely.
Genetic connection to the child. So they went and figured out how to do it. And, you know, they did what, you know, other couples who, you know, like us, they went to a fertility clinic, which is set up for other, you know, usually for straight couples who have some fertility challenge, and, you know, got help there.
And it's interesting how people go to great extents, understandably, and then at the extreme opposite, you have lawmakers and individuals, of course, going to great extents to prevent things of this nature.
It's bizarre how the encounter with the law has been really, you know, when I step back, really bizarre, because just to give you an example, you know, we went into this, the story I told about Tamar and Andy and us, and the eggs were from a close person to us, too. It was, everybody was on the same page. We were intending for me and Rich and I are going to be the parents, and we're bringing this child into the world together with much deliberation and much love, and, you know, we had little rituals. All of it was just, you know, great intention. And then when it came to the law, we actually had to literally sue Tamar and Andy for parental rights.
Wow.
Because in the state that they lived in, Virginia, they were the presumed parents by law. And, you know, it was just on paper. It's not like we, you know, went to court and were, you know, fighting. But the law treated us like we were in an in a adversarial relationship to each other, when the opposite, like beyond the opposite, was true. It was so far from that. So I saw that a lot, that the law, and, you know, that's even just the legal stuff on paper, not the people who are trying to, you know, publicly demean and stop this kind of family making from happening. You know, it was true for everybody, for single women adopting, faced those kinds of obstacles, legal obstacles and social stigma. And, you know, it's just it's an interesting contrast between the way the institutions are trying to treat this kind of family making and what's happening at the personal level and the love and intention that's going in, which is, I guess, one of the reasons I wanted to tell all of the story, the sort of the whole story with those encounters with institutions and the joy.
Joshua Gamson, do me a favor, touch on multifamilies, because I think it's very intriguing. I'm sure our listeners will enjoy learning more about this.
You mean multi-parent families?
Yes, multi-parent families. We're not talking about dwelling.
No.
Yeah, it sounds like a dwelling.
The
talking
one
about.
In the book, I'll tell you about the one in the book briefly, and then I'll tell you how it, you know, the response that's common. So the my friends in the book, it's basically Richard's best friend, so my best friend-in-law.
Best friend-in-law, I love it.
She decided she wanted to have a family, and she's involved with a woman. She still is, same woman. And she initially approached a male friend of hers to be a sperm donor and dad. She wanted to have a male involved in the life in some way who wouldn't have legal obligations. They would work it out. You know, they would work out the terms of it. And he was involved with a man, so a gay friend of hers, I told you it's complicated. The simplified version is two women and two men built a family together that from the start was multiple parents. So they wound up doing it through adoption, which is also interesting because usually when people do that, if they attempt to do it biologically and that doesn't work out, the potential dads sort of drop out. But in this case, they were like, let's build this family together. They adopted a child from Nepal and then later a child from India who was older. And they're raising the kids together in two separate households. They're mostly with the moms and then some of the time with the dads. And I know several other families like that just in my own sort of networks. And, you know, people hear that and they're like, oh, that's so, you know, unusual, multi-parent families. And then I tend to point out that multi-parent families are all around us. We just don't
realize it. Sure.
See them that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, we realize that there's all of these divorce, you know, the divorce rate is enormous.
That's
people
exactly
often remarry. They often have kids and they're raising kids just like this other family.
Absolutely. It's just so from the get-go.
Fascinating too. Mm-hmm. Right.
Interesting.
Exactly.
So now as a sociologist, and this is a huge macro question, I mean, what's your perspective on this in a macro sense? I mean, do you think as a society we have, like, obviously ways to go in the in terms of the content of your book, in terms of progression, in terms of politics, in terms of opening people's eyes?
I think we have a ways to go in a lot of areas. I think in the sort of recognition of family diversity, I don't think we're that far off. I think people are, you know, some of it's just that it's publicly visible.
Certainly on a coast.
It's entering school systems. Mm-hmm. You know, you see TV shows like Modern Family that display different kinds of family forms. That's the whole source of that's the whole setup of the show. I think, you know, people are curious about stories like mine and the others in the book and are somewhat open to them. There's, of course, the people who want to push us back to some mythical ideal of traditional family that you were describing at the outset, as though that's possible, as though that ever really existed for more than a short period of time. But I don't think that's going anywhere. You know, the families are what they are at this point. And the areas where I think we have a lot of ways to go are things like support for different types of families, like legal change that recognizes the intentions of people in their family making. Like making sure that the financial obstacles are not so tremendous. I mean, the way it works now with both adoption and assisted reproduction, you know, medically assisted reproduction, but especially assisted reproduction cost a lot of money. And, you know, that's barely built into the insurance system, and, you know, it's very haphazard.
Sure, and that's a whole another topic we don't have time for. The whole insurance, I mean, of course, they would be not in favor for a lot of things being passed.
Right, and it's not built into the public health system. There are ways that we could go to make it so that it's not like, you know, I'm a professor and doctor. We can, you know, we have some borrowing power. Mm-hmm. We're going to be in debt for this forever, but we could do it and other people can't.
And
you know, that's
sure.
not right. And there's a lot of work to be done in those areas and in supporting people in building the extended kinship networks that really help when you're raising a kid by yourself, for instance. You know, there's a lot of areas that I touch on in the book.
Joshua, we're running short on time, but I wanted to mention a great foreword by Melissa Harris Perry, host of MSNBC's her show, Melissa Harris Perry. And also, very quickly, if you could give some insight to PR listeners about maybe who would consider embarking in marriage and parenting in a non-traditional manner, if you can. Read the book.
Read the book. And think about the things that we thought about on our way, and I think you're in better shape to do it.
Book is everywhere, correct?
Yes, it is.
And it's published by NYU?
Yep.
Modern Family Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. Is there a website for this, Joshua?
My website, joshuagamson.com.
And that's Gamson, Joshua, real pleasure. And you know what's funny? When I was in college, I thought being a sociologist would be very, very compelling.
I think it's a fun job.
Yeah, I love people and the study of nature and people and what makes people tick, et cetera. And so, and first of all, that you've put a culmination of your life events, personal stories like this together. You've done a great deed for society.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Joshua.
Okay.
All the best to you. This is PRN's Insight. My name is Mark Farrell. We'll be right back after this with Elaine Kwan.
PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
The mind is the brain.
The mind is a garden we tend.
The mind is a hive of memes.
The mind is a monkey who needs to chill.
The mind is a magic deck.
The mind is a web, and you are a spider.
Looking for in-depth conversations about mysticism and mind science?
Technology and visionary experience?
Religion and uncanny culture?
Tune in to Expanding Minds.
With Eric Davis.
And Maja Daou.
On the Progressive Radio Network.
Or download us on iTunes.
And remember,
keep your mind open.
Progressive Radio News Hour is an antidote to government and corporate propaganda. Distinguished guests are featured. Some are world figures. All are independent thinkers. Truth and full disclosure are featured. Vital domestic and world issues mattering most are discussed. Today is the most perilous time in world history. Ukraine's crisis escalated things dangerously. It's the gravest one since World War II. A potential clash of civilizations looms. More than ever, vital information is needed. It's our most precious commodity. How we use it matters most. Peace and security depend on it. The Progressive Radio News Hour, three times weekly, live on Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, plus two pre-recorded archive programs. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
Join the movement at PRN.FM, your best source for progressive programming.
It's Insight on PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Thursday morning in New York City, wherever you are, hopefully it's as nice as it is here as wherever you are. We're falling back this weekend. Bummer. Real bummer. But the good news is that, you know, for like 3 or 4 years now, the point of which in time we fall back is later, and then we spring ahead earlier. So the darker days are lessened, whatever, we're saving more on our CFL bulbs and all that jazz. Anyway, hopefully we do away with all that, because I still don't understand why we're falling back. Daylight savings time, I don't get it. So could you imagine, at the head of the show, I talked about a person, and I said, yes, how could this be one person? A concert pianist, MIT professor, five-time national Taekwondo national champion, Wilhelmina model, and there's more. Yeah, she's a president of a very important organization, and you're going to find out more about that. Introducing Elaine Kwan. Elaine, how are you?
Hey, Mark.
It's been years.
Yeah, it's been, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years.
You look amazing.
Oh, thanks.
Your biography has grown since we've met years ago. It's unbelievable. And I have to add on to this, you're Oprah-fied.
Oh, Oprah-fied, yes.
I think that should be the name of your book, Oprah-fied.
I managed to get on before the show ended, so I'm real thankful
That's
about
amazing.
That.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was
How
a
did
great
you,
experience.
What aspect, because she obviously saw all the things that you've accomplished in life, what did you go on for? All of your accomplishments?
They were mentioned, but it was more about health and life philosophy of how to live.
Oh, you're far from healthy. Yeah. You look so sedentary, junk food addict. That's you. The fitness model for Wilhelmina. I mean, some of the pictures on your website, ElaineKwan.com, are just amazing. And some of the ones I have to ask you, because I always wonder this, like when you're in flight and you're smiling and your muscles are all pumped and you look amazing, are you on a trampoline? Are you on a padded surface? Because it looks like you'd have to be or in space where there's no gravity, where you can hold such a pose.
It depends on the shot. I mean, the Nike shots I've done that show me flying through the air, I was jumping off a table. So I jumped off a table at least 50 times and triggered the camera.
And then went to the ER.
Yeah, I know. The next day I was kind of sore. Yeah, and other ones I'm just jumping, you know.
Really?
So, yeah.
In a studio?
Studio or outside or wherever.
Do they have padding for you to land on? I mean, it looks like it's, whoa.
No padding.
All right, all right. Where do we start with you, Elaine? Okay, you're born in Korea.
Yes.
And you came to the States at what age?
Oh, 1.5 years old. So just a baby. You know, my father was a diplomat in Korea, and he gave it all up and moved everyone over, and we started over again.
And at age 15, you had your first concert?
Well, no, actually, my first concert was probably, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 years old.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You were a late bloomer.
Yeah, no, I really am a late bloomer. But I was playing piano super early in life. So my mom started teaching me when I was about 4 years old.
How talented was she?
She was great. I mean, she was a beautiful pianist, just not a professional musician.
Sure.
But she taught my older sister, who's 2 years older. And so my sister was taking lessons from her. And then, of course, I wanted to do it. And I grew up in a small town in Pullman, Washington. And, you know, there wasn't much for us to do. And it was, you know, it was tough. And we were Korean and there weren't many Asians. So
far from diverse.
Yeah. So, you know, piano was a way
of... Was that your refuge?
It was. It was something that I did. I don't think I realized how much I loved doing it until I was faced with having to give it up. So that's when I really made my choice. But I was doing music, so very seriously.
And why were you faced with giving it up?
You know, my parents didn't want me to be a musician.
Really?
You know? Yeah. I mean, I have
as gifted as you were, so young.
Yeah,
they didn't see you as truly gifted.
No, it's more that they wanted me to have a steady income and a really good life. You know, my parents were immigrants. They didn't want me to suffer and work
Understandable,
hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so being a musician, well, that's like, well, how are you going to support yourself?
Fly by night.
Yeah, it's going to be so hard. And it came initially from concern for me, of course. But what they didn't realize was that it's what I loved and wanted to do. It's what I had been doing so seriously all of my childhood. I didn't learn how to ski or skate or swim or play tennis or anything like that because I was practicing the piano. So I had to make a decision and go off and do music.
Yeah, well, obviously you've done a lot of studying as well. You have a doctorate from musical arts from Boston University, great school, master's of music from New England Conservatory, highest honors and a distinction, I can go on for a while here, and performances award and a bachelor of music from University of Texas in Austin, highest honors and the academic All-American Award. And this is edited down. Wow. So when did you actually part from music for a while?
You know, I never really fully parted from it, but I did take some time off around 2001, 2002, and I actually just traveled for the first time, really.
All around the world.
Yeah, that's nice. I was in Bali and Paris and Australia, and I really took some time for myself. It was great, and I spent all my money, but, you know, I took some time.
Sure. So at this point, you haven't had, like, a slew of major concert experience under your belt, correct?
Up until that point?
Yes.
Sure. I've been performing for a long time. But my, most recently, you know, I've been doing Carnegie Hall now. This will be for the 7th year coming up in May.
Carnegie Hall, I wasn't going to mention it, but, you know.
a benefit concert every year for Best Buddies.
How we met.
Yeah.
Great organization.
So wonderful. I'm so thankful and grateful to be involved with them. This will be the 7th year on May 24th.
And so we should mention, obviously, we're going to go all over the place this morning because we have a lot of ground to cover. Save Your Senses, you're the founder and president of a really innovative concert series which pairs live music, sometimes yourself on piano. And I see this in like a loft setting, a very cool restaurant, not a lot of people, but all the food is procured and made very, very special and delectable by an incredible chef.
That is one of the Save Your Senses events. It has grown. I mean, we've done, I don't know, maybe 30 of them.
Wow.
And I co-founded it in 2009.
I thought there were only 5 senses. We've grown to 30. I'm really behind.
All kinds. I mean, Savor Your Senses is really what it is now. It's a performance series that pairs music with wine and music with food or music with spirits. soon to be Music with Beer, and Music with Other Sensory Arts, and then at the same
Music with Talk Radio.
Yeah, we could
and beer
do that.
And
yeah.
Talk Radio. Hey, I'm on to something.
Next time,
yes.
I'll pair something with your.
Hey, can we have an intern
show?
Go out and get a 6-pack of some German beer? Thank you.
We could definitely do that.
Why not? Why not? But, so this is a great event. All right, so we got to go back here. We got to go back. Okay, so you got all these great degrees behind you, and then you traveled the world, and then you said, "What am I going to do with this?"
And moved to New York, and then I initially didn't. I was still playing some 2 piano concerts. I toured with another pianist, which I love doing that. But I was in New York, and I did some fitness things for Nike, and all my martial arts, which I've always loved and carried with me, you know, throughout. So that's what I started doing in the city.
So you weren't much into sports as a youngster, because you're always
right.
playing the piano. So when did you start feeling the athletic prowess in you come out?
I didn't really know I was athletic until...
until you could fly through the air and no, hold and pose for 10 seconds for someone to take 50 pictures?
I really didn't know that when I was growing up, because I didn't do sports, right? I didn't do any of that. But it wasn't until I actually was at BU getting my doctorate. There was a Taekwondo team, and I'd always wanted to do it because I would watch my father growing up. He would do it out in the backyard. I'd see him kicking, and he would be punching, and
it's mesmerizing to watch.
I just wanted to do it so much. He said, "Oh, you're going to hurt your hands. You have to be careful."
Sure.
Yeah. So finally, I said, you know what? Forget that.
Exactly.
I want to do it. And now it's a completely integrated part of my life. I mean, it is in my life in. Just like taking a shower mm-hmm. every day, brushing your teeth, do my martial arts, do, you know.
So you do the martial arts in the shower while you're brushing your teeth?
Yes, you should see my bathroom. Okay. It's massively big.
I think you
big.
Can, you know, multitask by all means. If no. you can't do it, nobody can. I mean, geez. So when did this take on more of a big part of your life? Obviously, you put a lot of time and effort. 5-time national Taekwondo champion. I mean, that's a lot of time and dedication.
It's a lot of time. Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it's
second
informed.
Degree black belt.
Yes, second degree black belt, and I those awards were in forms. So I was not competing in sparring. So that's different. I was doing forms and creative forms.
Okay, you have to break that down for me and some other people.
So
break that down, girl.
So sparring is one-on-one fighting.
Yes.
Forms is where you present the different forms that are involved in the martial arts. So it's almost like a solo routine.
Without the piano.
Without the piano, right. But in that sense, it carried over easily for me from piano. Because I could work on these myself. It was a performance.
Sure.
You know,
the mindset.
You start, yeah, right in the middle
timing.
Of the whole mat, and you show the art. And so
without
that's
the conductor.
What I did. It, correct, right,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
And now I train Shaolin Kung Fu down at the USA Shaolin Temple. I switched over. And
is that a very old art form?
Oh, yes, thousands of years old. And I love it so much. It's very different. But
still solo?
It's about action meditation. So the idea is that you're moving through the Shaolin Kung Fu forms and training, and it's meditation. So it's just about focus and purpose.
Where do you feel more escapism and or I don't want to pin you down and say what you like more, because first of all, that's so predictable and you probably may not even know which one you like more, but where do you lose yourself more, on the piano or when you're doing any martial arts?
It's pretty equal, because
let's go out and get a 6-pack.
Yeah,
you know, you'll feel a little bit more loose.
I
and
would
then
say
you'll know.
It's both, because both need focus, and both to me are a kind of meditation as well. So,
how did you get the Carnegie Hall?
Oh my goodness. Well, you know, definitely practice for sure. These concerts are for best buddies. So someone approached me to do a benefit concert.
We should tell people that Best Buddies is an organization for individuals with physical and cognitive disabilities.
Yeah, it's right. Intellectual developmental
correct.
Disabilities. And it pairs those people with friends and jobs.
Yeah.
So it's about pairing them to make their life better.
And isn't one of the Kennedys the executive director?
Yes,
Best Buddies?
Anthony Shriver Kennedy.
That's
sure.
right.
Yeah, he's the founder of that. And every year since 2000, well, not every year, we did skip a year. We've done concerts at Carnegie Hall, Lane Kwan and Friends. It just started very simply.
And Friends? I wasn't invited.
Yeah.
I could have done something. I could introduce
we
you.
We invited you that
I
year.
I could have picked up your dress. Oh, that's another question I have for you. Watching your video, one of the hardest things, it's not the endless time and hours and years playing the piano, is how do you get that beautiful, luxurious, breathtaking gown to sit so perfectly on the bench?
You know, that's the last thing I'm worrying about when I'm there.
That's
I'll
right,
tell
last
you that
thing
much.
You probably thought I was going to ask you.
Yes,
that, right?
Exactly. It's so funny, but yet the gown is so visible. I don't know.
It works. Whatever you're doing, it works.
Hey, I'm really not a fashion person. For my Carnegie Hall concerts, I'm styled by Chuck Thomas.
Oh.
He's a great stylist, and so he provides the gowns, and I wear them.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
And
can't walk out the door.
Don't think
that,
about
right?
it. Yeah.
Let's hear a sample. You brought some music this morning. We didn't get the piano. Hey, Gary! Gary, no, you know, owns a network. You didn't get that piano? You can't hear me soundproof. We have these beautiful new studios here. But you brought a sample of music. What are we going to hear?
I did. I brought the first movement of a recording I made several years ago with the Slovak Sinfonietta and conductor Carrie Stratton. We recorded this in Toronto, and it's a piano concerto by the composer Anton Rubinstein. And he was a Russian composer who was more known for being a fantastic virtuoso pianist. He would just play for 5 hours and, you know, break strings and things like that. And so,
and you're just about to come in a few seconds. We're going to hear a moment of this because we don't have time for all 12 minutes, so I apologize in advance. Enjoy this. That's Elaine Kwan, my guest this morning, concert pianist, and that is just absolutely beautiful.
Oh, thank you. I love this concerto so much.
Why so?
You know, it's got all the fun stuff for pianists. It really does, because Anton Rubinstein himself was a pianist, so it's got octaves and great runs and flashy, and it's beautifully sentimental, unabashedly sentimental, I'd say, and... yeah, I love it so much that I made a shorter piano arrangement that I could play solo. So I wouldn't have to play it with an orchestra.
Well, there you go, because it's hard to travel on a New York City bus with an
yes,
orchestra.
It's
a little bit costly.
Yeah, I got tired of cramming all the cellos.
Absolutely.
Down. Yeah, no.
And you are a composer, and you've written some music for, did it air on a show?
Oh.
Or a Broadway show?
You know, I guess I don't consider myself too much of a composer, but I have written some things. One, I did write music for a one-woman Shakespearean play called Corsetless.
I love that name, Corsetless.
Corsetless, yes, and it was actually turned into a movie, and now it's coming out in a different name called Live. And I've done a lot of arrangements.
And you have the music rights to that?
No, I did not do the music for the film, yeah, but it originally started with this play.
What happened? Was your lawyer away on vacation or something that week? Come on, Elaine.
No.
You're too busy. You need a manager. Let's get Elaine a manager with that six-pack.
Yeah, right.
Tell me about Life Chord.
Life Chord. Oh, you found Life
Chord. We're hitting everything,
Yeah,
Elaine.
You are. Life Chord. Okay, so this is really my life philosophy and the platform and the way that I move through my world. It is a selective combination of my passion, health, and purpose, and I call it my PHP.
The legal form.
Exactly. And these are woven together to just create the most harmonious and effective and happy lifestyle. So my passion's my music. I mean, that's just core of who
evidence.
I am. Fundamentally, you know, how I move through the world. My my health is martial arts. And that's such an, like I said, integrated part of my life, right? It keeps me focused. And then purpose is teaching. And it's my teaching that I do at MIT. It's
since
the teaching.
Since 1999?
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah, I love
good
it
for you.
So much. And the teaching I do through my Savor Your Senses concerts. So that's all, they're all three are woven together to form a chord.
Hmm.
You know how a musical chord is
sure.
like two or more notes that sound great together. Or a rope cord, right? Has the strands
sure,
are stronger
absolutely.
Together. And
yeah.
I think every person has, if you can find and figure out your own life cord, then you're living at your sort of optimal level. And everyone has their passion, health, and purpose. And maybe you might not know what each one is
sure.
at a specific time.
And
but,
what
you know,
the significance is in terms of comparison ratio of all things combined.
Yeah. And then it can switch through your life as well. But I think we all need that.
How did modeling enter your life?
The fitness. Yes.
Did you get approached?
When
you were midair?
Yeah.
Hey, you want to come down? I think you'd make a good model.
You know, I for those Nike ads, I just happened to see an ad looking for women who do different sports.
Really?
And yeah.
Did you cold call Wilhelmina?
And I went. No, I didn't. I didn't. I went and I auditioned and I got it. And then years later, probably about 5 years later, Wilhelmina, the fitness director of Wilhelmina, approached me to join
and
come on board. So
good. I mean, you have everything. You have the look, the physical beauty, the facial beauty.
So nice.
Well, no. That's I mean, nice. Obviously, ambiguous. What's the word I'm looking for? Racially ambiguous as well. I mean, that's so in vogue.
Really? Wow,
yeah,
I
don't
didn't
you
know
think?
That.
Absolutely.
I'm full-blooded Korean.
Well, you know, but when you're up in the air, you know, and your head's partially turned, you know, you can't really tell.
Right?
Exactly. I could be Korean if I'm flying in the air and my head's spinning around, I'm turning all different colors. So tell me about, quickly, we're running out of time, Save Your Senses. The next event is November 6th, right here in New York at Vinter's Wine Shop, 21 Warren Street. And you can get tickets at newyorkvinters.com. That's New York, spelled out, vinters.com.
Vinters
with a V.
Vinters.
Vinters. Anyway, what can people expect?
Okay, so at this one, I'm so excited about. I'm teaming up with the executive chef, Ryan Smith, and we're pairing music with five courses that he's preparing. And I've got singers Angelica de la Riva, Ryland Angel, and we're putting together a whole Mad Libs story, too.
Oh.
Around it. Ryland Angel's founder of Kitchen Opera Company, and he's got these great songs about chocolate and about food, and the audience will participate, because that's part of it, is audience participation. So Savor Your Senses, November 6th.
And what's the actual size of an audience of this nature? 50 people?
Oh, this one will be about 30 people.
Oh, that's great.
But we
Very
just
intimate.
Did one for 300 people at the Sheen Arts Center.
And you'll be there.
Well, that happened in September, but I
mean,
will definitely, yes. Oh, yes, I'm playing
Come
on Friday night.
Come and meet Elaine Kwan. Check her out at elainekwan.com. My name's Mark Farrell. Good luck to all the New York City marathoners. I can't believe you're not running this Sunday.
not this time.
Forget to fall back, and a happy Halloween. Go Mets. Are you a baseball fan?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Oh, I love
but
that
go,
answer.
Go New York Mets.
Elaine, you're the best. Oprah-fied and all, even without Oprah. My name's Mark Farrell. The show's Insight. Catch you next Thursday. Enjoy.